Questions asked in the aftermath might be a whole lot different. Instead of why did those 44 have to die, it's why did 5 million have to die? Why did the whole Eastern Seaboard have to die? At that point, nobody has the luxury of a tribunal. At that point, everyone's just trying like hell not to get sick. Question. So you're saying? Answer. I'm saying that the decisive actions of men like me make second-guessing possible. We're the first guessers. And sometimes that's all it is, educated guesswork. We don't know how bad it might get. We assess the risk, gauge what the collateral damage might be, try to minimize it, and then hold that course. I'm not saying it doesn't make for some uneasy nights, but that's what you have to do. Question. Admiral, I'd like to change course. Answer. It's your circus, you can call the tune. Question. Wonderful. Admiral, did you know about Dr. Clive Edgerton and his experiments with the modified hydatid worm? Answer. Before all this, no. Question. Remind me, you did sit on the panel of the Board of Safety in the fields of communicable diseases and epidemiology, did you not? Answer. I have, as I'm required to by duty. Question. So then I find it odd that... Answer. Yes? Question. I find it odd that you'd have no knowledge of Dr. Edgerton. I say so because the board you sit on, is very aware of Dr. Edgerton. 2 years ago, his name was brought up in conjunction with several other doctors. According to the board, the work of those doctors should be subject to a higher degree of oversight and scrutiny, seeing as their research could pose a significant risk. Answer. I don't go to every meeting. Question. But they send you the minutes. Answer. Yes. I read them as thoroughly as I can, but my schedule is busy. Question. Admiral, what are your thoughts on the effectiveness of the mutated hydatid as it applies to warfare? Answer. I think it's monstrous. It's a monstrous question. Question. Yes, I'm afraid it is, but such questions need to be posed. You say it's monstrous. Answer. I do indeed. Question. That's not the question I asked you. Answer. I suppose it would be effective as a weapon in certain very prescribed situations. Question. Like on an island? Answer. What's your name? Question. Name redacted. Answer. Well, name redacted, if you are suggesting that I dragged my feet and somehow used those kids as what, test subjects? If you're suggesting that... Question. Admiral, does the name Claude Lafleur ring a bell? Answer. No. Why should it? Question. Master Seaman Claude Lafleur was one of your men. Answer. The entire Navy is my men. Question. Master Seaman Claude Lafleur was stationed at the same base you operated out of. Lafleur's daughter often babysat your children. You're saying you don't know Claude Lafleur? Answer. That's right. Question. Claude Lafleur was a locksmith before entering the Navy. Answer. You want to hurry this up? Question. As you already noted, this is my circus, Admiral. I'll choose the pace. Some time ago, Claude Lafleur was given a 4-day executive leave. That leave started the day before Tom Paget escaped from Dr. Edgerton's facility. Answer. Yes. So? Question. Are you aware that you signed Claude Lafleur's leave papers, Admiral? Answer. I signed plenty of leave papers. I spend half the day signing papers. Question. Are you aware, Admiral, that Claude Lafleur's fingerprints were found on the rear access door of Dr. Edgerton's lab? Answer. You'll have to speak to someone else about that. Question. Are you aware that we presently have Claude Lafleur in custody? Are you also aware that Lafleur has some fairly damning things to say? Answer. You'll have to talk to my superiors about that. Question. Admiral, who are your superiors? Answer. Witness maintains silence. Question. Are you saying that even admirals take orders from someone? Answer. Witness maintains silence. Question. Admiral, just earlier you used a term I'd like to revisit. Monstrous. Perhaps you'd agree, Admiral Brewer, that purposely releasing a contagion would be monstrous. And if Tom Paget were that contagion admiral, then wouldn't it stand to reason that Falstaff Island could be seen as no less than a giant petri dish, and the events that occurred there no less than an unsanctioned experiment on children? Answer. Witness maintains silence. Question. Wouldn't that just be absolutely monstrous, Admiral? Wouldn't that be the most inhuman thing you could ever imagine? Answer. Witness maintains silence. Chapter 45. Nightfall greeted the boys as they stumbled out of the cavern. In the silvery fall of moonlight, Newton saw that he was soaked in gore from the waist down. Revulsion swept over him in a dizzying wave. When Max approached with a handful of leaves, all he could find for Newton to clean himself on, Newton held his hand out. "Don't come near me. It's too late. They're all over me." He could feel them inside his pants, prickling his skin with strange heat. They wriggled in the hairs he'd just started to grow down there. Max said, "What can we do?" "Get back to camp. I'll wash up in the ocean, see if that helps." They moved through the woods without a flashlight. Chilling noises emanated from the lacework of tall trees, hoots and scufflings, and a frenzied cackle that rose up and up until it dropped to an ongoing buzz like an enormous hummingbird trapped in a rain barrel. Whatever was making those sounds couldn't possibly be any worse than the shellite thing back in the cavern. When they got back, Max made a fire using shingles that had blown off the cabin roof. Newton went down to the water to wash. Max could just make him out past the moon-glossed shore. He sat cross-legged in the surf, scrubbing and scrubbing. He returned in only his underwear, which sagged wetly around his hips. There was a defeated hunch to his shoulders that freaked Max out. "I'm hungry, Max. I'm hungry too, Newt. I think I'm hungrier than you." Somehow, they slept. In the witching hours, Newton sat bolt upright. His insides were alive and seething. He bit down on his lip until blood came. An hour later, Max awoke as Newton puked into a thicket of poisoned sumac. He was curled up on his side, breathing in rapid little bursts. "I took the mushrooms," he said. "They do the trick." Newton pointed at the puddle of vomit, nothing but a thin smear of liquid tinged purple from the berries they'd eaten. It was alive with wriggling whiteness. "I figure one of the little buggers swam up my piss hole." He realized there was a better word for it, a scientific word that he probably even knew, but he was too dog-tired to think of it. Besides, piss hole summed it up best. It was a hole that your piss came out of. Newton laughed to himself. Ha! For whatever reason, he found it deliciously funny. Piss hole. Hilarious. WWAMD. He'd laugh at piss hole too, because it was the funniest word on earth. Maybe he was delirious. That or those mushrooms had mind-bending properties. He tore out a clump of poisoned sumac and rubbed it on his leg. "What are you doing?" Max said. "It'll give me something else to focus on. I can itch myself silly." Newton ate the rest of the mushrooms and was violently, frighteningly ill. He vomited with such force that the capillaries burst in his eyes and even his nose. By the time the sun came up, he looked washed out and haggard, as though his innards had all been wrung out like wet washcloths. They lay together by the fire. Anytime Max moved closer, Newton waved him back tiredly. "You're going to catch it," he warned. "I don't care anymore." Heat kindled in Newt's eyes. "You should care. Don't be stupid. You should care." Max withdrew, wounded for reasons he couldn't quite process. Sometime that morning, the black helicopter cut across the postcard-pretty sky. It dipped low, rotors throbbing, panning a circle around them. It was so close that Max could see the sunlight flashing off the pilot's visor. "Help us!" he yelled as the blades whipped debris all around. "He's sick! Can't you see that? We need help!" The pilot's face remained impassive. Max picked up a rock, threw it on a pitiful trajectory. It wasn't even close. The helicopter banked southward and returned toward North Point.
Fuck you!
Max screamed as it retreated.
Go fuck yourself!
Afterward, he collapsed. The adults were supposed to act in the best interests of the children. They had to know what was happening, yet stubbornly they did nothing but stand idly by. The adults were content to watch them die.
I wonder who built them, Newton murmured.
Max wiped his eyes. Built what?
The worms.
I don't know what you mean.
I mean, Newton said, they seem too perfect.
They don't seem perfect at all, Newt. They're like the worst things on Earth.
That's what I mean, I guess. Maybe they are the worst things on Earth, but that would make them perfect, wouldn't it? Perfect at being what they are and doing what they do. Perfect killers.
They haven't killed everyone. We don't know about Kent. Newton's eyes pinched up at the edges.
I hope he's still alive. Really, I hope so.
He could have swum back. Max stared out over the slaty water and wondered if he really believed that.
If anyone could have, it would be Big K, Newton agreed, if only for Max's sake.
Maybe he'll talk to the adults. They'll finally come for us.
Anything is possible.
Around noon, Newton told Max he was having a hard time seeing out of his left eye.
It's all fuzzy around the sides.
His laugh held a lacy filigree of hysteria.
It's like staring at the world from inside a peach or something.
Max leaned over and inspected Newton's eye.
It looks okay.
Newton scratched at the purple stains on his legs from the poisoned sumac. He'd been scratching all morning. The flesh was raked open and bloody in spots.
It does? Okay, well, jeez, it hurts.
Maybe it's not my eye. I don't think there are any nerves in an eyeball. Maybe it's behind it, you think? Max knelt closer. Terror was building in his chest, gaining a keener edge.
Spread your eyelids with your fingers. I'll look.
Okay, Newton said dreamily.
Yeah, good idea.
Max held one hand up to shield his own eyes from the sun and squinted closely. Nothing, just bloodshot whiteness.
It's fine, Newt. I can't see.
His breath caught.
Can't see.
What?
What is it?
It was nothing. Just a teeny tiny quill. No bigger than an itty bitty claw on a baby mouse's paw. It sat at the bottom of Newton's eye. It was probably just a trick of the light or a sty or something. Until it moved.
What is it, Max? I can feel it.
The minuscule writhing worm lashed side to side as if stretching itself out in its new digs. Max reached out to grab it. Maybe he could tease it out of Newton's eye the way his grandfather used to pull coddling worms out of a crab apple. Until Max realized it was inside Newton's eye, swimming in the jelly.
No.
The word ran through his head on an endless loop.
No, 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 no.
It all at once went still. Then it seemed to flex toward Max, as if it knew, in the single vile atom it called a brain, that it was being watched.
What is it, Max? Tell me. Tell me.
Chapter 46. An hour later, Max was back at the cavern. Newton had asked him not to go, begged him.
What if something happens, Max? Then we'll both be alone.
Max simply waited until Newton fell asleep, the smallest kindness he could now afford. He'd found a signal flare in the cabin, the one Scoutmaster Tim had gotten drenched in the storm, but this one, which Newton had brought personally in a Ziploc bag, might still be okay. Max prayed it would work. If not, it meant going back down in the dark with the Shelly thing still there. He'd have to paw around blindly for the spark plugs. What if he touched it instead? Max had been happy enough to leave the plugs and try to figure out some other method of escape,
But now, with Newt as sick as he was, he had no choice. Listen, it'll be no big deal, he thought, bucking himself up. Go on down, grab the plugs, and get the heck out of Dodge. It's not even that far down. It just felt that way yesterday because you were in the dark. It's probably not much farther down than the basement stairs at home. The sun had fallen a few degrees in the sky. It shone brightly through the tree branches and into the cavern mouth. Bright as it was, after a few yards, the sunlight turned spotty and that awful darkness took over. He tore the strike strip. The flare burst alight with a heat so unexpected that it singed the hairs on his arms. They'd been standing on end, along with those on the nape of his neck. He nudged his foot into the cave mouth. The shadow of the overhang cleaved across his boot. He tried to take the next step, but his back leg wouldn't move. It may as well have been glued to the ground. The muscle fibers twitched down his hamstrings, antic, fluttering waves under his skin. Come on, he whispered. Come on. An act of profound concentration and willpower was required to budge his back leg. He finally threw it out in front of him in an awkward stagger step that nearly sent him tumbling down the steep grade of the cave, but he checked his forward momentum in time. Don't be a baby, Max said to himself, though he had every legitimate reason in the world to act like one. Scout law number 3, a scout's duty is to be useful and help others, and he is to do his duty before anything else, even though he gives up his own pleasure or comfort or safety to do it. The temperature dipped by 10 degrees as soon as he entered the cave. The air came out of his lungs in short, popping breaths. It almost sounded like he was hiccuping or on the verge of having a good cry. The fear was as strong as ever, that disembodied ball of baby fingers relentlessly tickling his guts. 1 foot in front of the other, he told himself. You can always run. You can pelt out of here like your ass is on fire. It amazed him that the voice in his head, confident, jokey, could be so different from the piss-scared boy it resided within. At least he had a flare. The journey was much less disorienting with a light to go by. Salt sparkled on the sea-eaten rock, tinted blood red by the flare light. The rocky shelves were overgrown with patches of sickly yellow moss. Colonies of huge white toadstools jutted from the cave walls at lunatic angles. They hung like fleshy ears, their undersides frilled with soft gills, or in some cases little spike-like teeth. Max's neck came in contact with one as he rounded a sharp bend in the descent, and it felt horribly clammy and bloated, like the flesh of a waterlogged body coughed up from the sea. The air was still sweet, but didn't seem as cloying. His breath came shallowly. He could hear the blood beat in his ears. The flare sputtered. Don't you go out, Max thought, prayed. Oh, don't you dare go out. He came to the mouth of the chamber. The smell was strangely enticing, sweet plums packed in salt. The air was alive with sounds, curiously stealthy over the drip of water. He held the flare aloft. The chamber's ceiling was clad in the same yellow moss, tendrils of witchgrass draped down. Trundling over the moss, clinging to its spongy folds, was an army of sea creatures, sand crabs and pulpy slugs and huge sightless beetles Max had never seen before. The clicking of their pincers and other appendages created a mammoth chittering above his head. The shelly thing lay to the side of the chamber. Its limbs were spiked out at odd angles. It looked like a dead spider pressed flat between the pages of a dictionary. So small. Death did that, didn't it? Shrunk everything. It lay in the same position as it had yesterday, didn't it? He wasn't so sure now. Maybe it had inched away from the cave wall, but how could it have done that? He pictured the things inside of Shelley doing that, somehow pulling Shelley's lifeless body along the cave floor. Max wondered if the chamber was fed by an aquifer leading out to sea. The tide might have rolled in, flooding the chamber. That would explain the sea life on the ceiling. He didn't think they'd been there before.
It would also explain the Shelly thing's positioning. The body would have floated up with the tide, bumping around the chamber, brushing into the walls, becoming saturated with seawater before settling on the floor as the tide flowed out. Had some of those worms flowed out with the tide? Max imagined them wriggling through the water, latching onto a codfish, which got eaten by a seal, which got eaten by a shark, which got caught in a drift net and hauled on board a trawler and slit open on the dock, billions of worms spilling out in front of the perplexed crewmen. Or maybe Shelley's body was in the exact same position. It had been dark and crazy. Yes, Max figured. It was in the same spot. Yes. He squinted past the sputtering flare light. Was anything else moving? He thought he saw floating flickers in the air, but no, those were just vapor contrails from the nearby seabed. He could hear the seethe of the sea seeping through the rock. The flare had already sputtered well down the paper tube. That shouldn't happen, should it? Maybe it was an old flare. Its glow had diminished alarmingly. He set one foot inside the chamber. His leg appeared to stretch out as if made of flesh-toned rubber, pulling the rest of his body with it. His throat was dusty dry, filled with the ozone taste of rock. The peripheries of his vision were blown out huge. He could see almost around the back of his head. His pupils were so dilated that they'd overtaken his corneas, turning them black. He inched around Shelley's body. A brittle strand of witchgrass brushed the back of Max's neck. He bit back a scream, but still, a breathless little moan came out of him. Which is when he noticed them. They were on the stick, the long one he'd sharpened yesterday, the one Newton abandoned in the madness. It jutted from beneath Shelley's body at a weird angle. All along it, stuck to the wet wood, were tiny nodules. Clustered in white bunches that looked like tiny albino grapes. Tens of thousands of them. Others were larger. They dotted the stick like curlicues of white icing on a cake. A sea slug fell from the ceiling, going plop in the puddle near the stick. The white nodules stirred in unison. The larger ones uncoiled and stood stiff. The sea slug sucked its way out of the puddle. Its eyes swiveled lazily on stalks. The large worms jettisoned off the stick, drifting with horrible languor. They settled atop the slug and swiftly coiled around it. The smaller nodules launched next, a shimmering flotilla settling around and atop the slug. Only its stalked eyes were visible amid the banded whiteness. Soon they too were cocooned. Max felt something bursting up inside him. A fearsome bubble packed with razor blades and fish hooks and shattered light bulbs that strained against the heaving walls of his chest. He inched around the Shelly thing, hugging the cave wall. Several more large worms went rigid. They followed him the way a compass needle follows magnetic north, but they didn't detach from the wood. The spark plugs weren't where he thought they'd be. He swore he'd last seen them next to the body, but then maybe the body had moved. Or something had moved the body. Or something else had moved the spark plugs. For an instant he was seized by a terrible possibility that something else was in the cave with him. An image formed in his head, something huge and pulsating white and gently, sensuously ribbed, gliding up behind him, making the soft suck-suck of a fat, toothless infant mewling for its mother's breast. There. Thank God, right there. He spotted the plugs in a shallow pool farther into the chamber. He must have flung them there last time he was here when the Shelly thing had reached for him. He edged around carefully, his butt scraping the wet rock. His eyes hunted through the dwindling smoky light for threats. They were all around him now. The flare was hot in his hand. The phosphorus was burning the last of its stores, heating through the cardboard tube. The plugs lay at the bottom of a weirdly ridged pool. It looked like the fossilized remains of a giant clam shell. He reached toward them, then suddenly flinched back. The dark, festering ooze ringing the puddle, a rotted mulch of witchgrass and kelp, was studded with white specks. They'd stirred agitatedly as his hand reached for the spark plugs. How had they known to surround this particular pool? But as Max's eyes dodged around in the ebbing light, he realized they were everywhere. They coalesced around him, specks of white nestled in the ooze, clustered in the rocks above him, to the sides of him. Everywhere. A deep vein of terror threatened to cleave him in half. He felt that tickle inside his skull now, those little fingers trying to unmoor his sanity. Almost absently, Max brought the flare down, singeing the edges of the puddle. The ooze sizzled, the worms exploded with little pops. He reached into the puddle, grabbed one spark plug. The flare went out. Max's heart seized. It sputtered a light again. The top was wet now. Water dribbled down into the tube, dousing the phosphorus. He reached for the other plug, wrapped his fingers around it. The flare went out again. Something dropped from the cave ceiling, crawling and clacking on the nape of his neck. Max let out a choked sound of disgust before the flare caught again. He knocked the thing off his neck. One of those huge black beetles. As soon as it hit the floor, it was lit upon by white strands. Max looked for the chamber mouth, and the flare went out. Jesus, oh, Jesus, no. He stood blindly, tripping, slipping on a patch of slime in the dark. He stumbled back and nearly fell. His arms reached out for balance and collided with something that felt like waterlogged fatback. The flare sputtered a light. In the blood-like luminescence, he saw he'd touched the shelly thing. His fingers had sunk into the flesh of its back. Its skin was flabby, greasy, seeping nameless, noxious fluid. The skin cracked slightly down the shelly thing's spine. Max saw something flex underneath. He turned to flee. The air was alive with floating strands. He waved the flare desperately, catching a few. They sizzled up like ghost fuses. He heard a hideous, skin-crawling sound, a splitting, rending sound. He froze. He pictured it being made by the shelly thing as it pulled itself up. It was the sound of its body disconnecting from the rocks, its burst-open chest cavity dangling syrupy strings of ichor, twisting with worms while it lisped, "Yes." Max couldn't bear to turn around. He feared if he turned and saw that, all would be lost. The terror would crystallize into a hot barbed nut in his brain. Maybe it would just be better to go mad and have done with it for good and all. With the greatest courage he'd ever summon, Max wrenched his head slowly around. The shelly thing's body was moving, but the movement was coming from inside.
1 foot in front of the other, Max.
It wasn't Max's own voice in his head now, it was Newton's.
It's just 5 steps, 4 maybe if you take long strides. Go on now, it's okay.
Max obeyed, moving quickly and silently. Every nerve ending was on fire, and every synapse in his brain was on the brink of rupture, but he managed to slip around the chamber walls until his ass hit the tunnel mouth. The last thing Max saw in the glow of the sputtering flare before racing up the incline was the skin cracking and splitting down the shelly thing's back. A huge white tube, just like the one that had ripped out of the stranger a lifetime ago, was twisted round the gleaming spine bone. It looked like a flag that had gotten blown round a pole in a high wind. Max watched it unfurl with slow elegance and rise into the dark air. It stood stiff as a bloodhound's tail with the hunt running hot in its blood. Chapter 47. When Max got back, Newton was awake. A patch of gauze was taped clumsily over his eye. The other eye stared at Max balefully.
You left, he said reproachfully.
I got the spark plugs.
That's good, I guess.
Newton looked thinner already. A jarring sight. Newton Thornton, the pudgiest boy in school, with winnowed cheekbones that looked as if they'd been carved out of basalt. The wind blew his loose clothes around his body.
Who needs deal-a-meal cards? He said, catching Max's look. Richard Simmons is a...
Newt managed to smile.
A fucking pussy.
He sat on a rock, humming a tuneless song, while Max fiddled with the boat's motor.
Night was already coming down. The cold seeped under their collars and iced the skin cladding their spines. I'm hungry like you wouldn't believe, Max. You should try sucking on a pebble. My mom says that's how the Indians used to control their hunger when they were on a vision quest or whatever. Newton plucked a pebble off the shore and popped it into his mouth. Salty, he said. And stony. They laughed a little. Max turned back to the motor. He screwed the spark plugs into their holes and snapped the covers shut. I swallowed the pebble, Newton said. Oops. Suck on another one, Max said, struggling to maintain a casual tone of voice. The jerry can of gasoline was where he'd dropped it yesterday. He unscrewed the motor's gas cap and let the gasoline glug-glug down, making sure he didn't spill any. He could hear grinding sounds over his shoulder. He was very worried they were being made by Newton chewing on a pebble. You should gather whatever you need, he said, not daring to look. We should leave soon. You don't even know that the motor will start, Newton said tiredly. It probably won't. Why would you say that, Newt? Why wouldn't it start? Why wouldn't you hope it'll start? Max turned and saw Newton regarding him with tragic eyes. All I mean is, Newton said, dropping his chin and staring down. Even if it does start, you should go alone. What a stupid... Why would I do that? Because I'm sick, Max. And if I'm sick, maybe they won't let you go back home, because they'll think you're sick too. They meaning who? Newton shrugged. Come on, don't be dumb. Whoever's out there, the police, the army, the guys in the helicopter, whoever is making sure nobody comes to rescue us. Well, maybe I'm sick already, too. Who cares? They can cure us. Newton shook his head knowingly. If you were sick, you'd feel it. Max came over and set a hand on Newton's shoulder. The heat radiated through his clothes. That awful sweetness wasn't so bad coming off Newton. It smelled a little like Toll House cookies. I'm scared, Max, Newton said softly. So am I, Newt. Max was afraid that if he left without Newt, they, whoever they were, wouldn't allow him to come back, which meant Newton would die here, curled up inside the cabin, perhaps, or in the cellar, like an animal that sought the darkness to die. He would die in pain, but more important and much worse, he would die alone. Newt didn't deserve that. Newt was a good person. He should live a long time, marry and have kids, teach them all the nerdy things he knew, be happy. That was the only fair outcome. But if Max left without Newt, he was positive he'd never see him again. This fear of abandoning Newt was more profound, if less visceral, than that which he'd experienced back in the cave. If Newton died, it meant all the terror and frustration and rage they'd both experienced had been for nothing. If they couldn't leave together, what had they done any of it for? Max said, "You sit at the front of the boat, okay? I'll sit at the back. We won't touch. They won't have any reason not to take me." Newton smiled gratefully. "That sounds like a very good plan, Max." Chapter 48. It was dark by the time Max eased the boat off the beach into the slack tide. It took a few hard cranks to get the motor going. Smoke belched from the engine housing. For one heart-stopping instant, it seemed the bearings would fry and the motor might seize. But after a few rough revolutions, it settled into an even cadence. Max goosed the throttle and piloted toward the distant lights of North Point. He'd driven boats before. His uncle was an oysterman, and he'd often let Max take the helm of his boat while he dragged in the lines. "It's a lot easier than driving a car," he'd told Max. "The ocean's just one big lane, plenty of room for everyone." Newton sat at the bow. He was wearing his scout sash, adorned with the badges he'd earned. He wasn't sure why he'd put it on. Maybe he wanted to show whoever was waiting for them that he was a responsible person, an individual of value. "Hey, Max," Newton called out over the motor. "Yeah?" "I had this dream today, while you were gone. It was pretty weird. Okay, so spill it.
Wind whipped off the water. Newton nearly had to shout to be heard. The effort drained him.
So, well, I was with my mom. We were on this trip. I didn't know the city. We were in this hotel lobby. Very swanky, which is weird because we don't have enough money to stay at swanky hotels. But we come through those rotating doors. Those doors always kind of scare me, actually. I think they're going to suck me between the glass and squash me. Through those doors, and there's a couple arguing outside. A man and a woman.
The swells grew larger as the shore receded. The boat skipped over the waves, salt spray licking up over the gunwales. Max squinted over the night water. Shapes loomed against the horizon.
The man started hitting the woman, right there on the street. Her head was snapping back. Blood was painted on her cheeks. Then this van stops on the sidewalk. These guys get out and start yelling at the other guy, saying he can't do that. The guy says he wasn't really hurting her, only teaching her something. So he wraps his hands around her neck as if to demonstrate. He wraps his hands around her neck and starts choking her right in front of these guys.
The shapes were beginning to coalesce. A loose group clustered where the water met the night sky, blocking out the lights of home.
One of the guys from the van puts the guy in a headlock. They drag him away from the woman and over to the van like they're going to throw him into it. Suddenly, people are pouring out of doorways and out of office buildings, carpenters and lawyers and deliverymen. The woman who was being choked starts screaming at the guys from the van, telling them to leave the guy who was choking her alone. Then one of the guys from the van punches the choker guy in the face. He goes down in a tangle, unconscious before he even hits the ground. He was wearing loose pants, I remember, and they fell down so I saw his underwear, which were blue and droopy with holes like mice had chewed them.
Boats. Squat ones that had chased down Calvin Walmack's cigarette boat. They were painted with some kind of special black paint that prevented the moonlight and starlight from reflecting off them. They floated silently, motionlessly.
Things sped up. Everyone was getting punched or punching. Fights were spilling out all over the street. I remember a tricycle getting crushed under the wheels of a speeding car. Then the choker guy who got punched out gets up and looks around all embarrassed and says, "Oh, hell no!" And he wades into this big, huge fight, which was everywhere by then, hitching up his pants. And there were fires burning at the tops of the skyscrapers and sirens everywhere, and I could tell, in that weird way dreams have of telling you things, that the violence was everywhere. Like a virus, Max. Everywhere.
The boat drew nearer to the floating vessels. Max cut the motor and drifted with the current. Figures were massed along the decks.
Newton's voice dropped as the wind dipped. My mom got her hand on my shoulder. I shrugged it off. I didn't want her touching me. And if she put her hand back on my shoulder, and I was thinking she might do that, Max, for the same reason that I wanted to shrug it off, then I might shove it off. Or bite her fingers. Violence was in the air, Max. We were all breathing it.
A searchlight snapped on, pinning them in its cool glare. The boys raised their hands slowly, like robbers who'd gotten caught inside a bank vault.
We need help, Max yelled.
Nobody answered.
We're okay.
He tried to smile. His filthy clothes flapped in the wind.
We made it. Tell them, Newt. Tell them we're okay.
Newton seemed unsure of where he was. One eye stared without recognition. He laughed, a weird, jittery laugh that bounced off the water and fled into the empty vault of sky. Max thought,
oh no, please don't laugh like that, Newt.
Newton stood up in the boat. He held his hands out toward the light, a gesture of supplication.
I'm fine. I'm aces. But there is one thing.
No, Newt.
I am very,
no, Newt, no, Newt,
so very, very,
no, 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 no.
The wind rose to a shriek that sucked that final word out of Newton's mouth. A hole appeared in the back of Newton's neck, a small hole that appeared as if by magic, presto. The torn edges of his flesh blew back, creating a perfect little starfish.
Newton pitched over the side. He lay on the sea's surface for an instant, like a water skimmer, those bugs that danced across the water's skin before the sea claimed him. Newt's body went head first, bubbles trailing up from the new hole in his throat as he sank swiftly beneath the boat. Max barely had time to cry out. He was staring down at the bright red dot hovering on his own chest. From the sworn testimony of Lance Corporal Frank Ellis, given before the Federal Investigatory Board in connection with the events occurring on Falstaff Island, Prince Edward Island. Question. Hungry. Answer. Yes, sir. Question. That's the word you heard Newton Thornton say before you shot him. Answer. Yes, sir, it was. He said he was hungry. Question. He said it just like that? Answer. No, sir, I suppose he said it more quietly, and there were some pauses in his speech. He said something like, I'm very, very hungry. Question. If he said it so quietly, are you certain he said it at all? It was night on the ocean. The weather reports for that evening indicated high winds. Answer. That's all true, sir. It was windy and choppy, but the big ears picked his voice up loud and clear. Question. I'm sorry? Answer. The big ears is what we call it. It's a parabolic listening device, a big dish, basically. Looks like a satellite dish. It's for long-range acoustical assessment, which is really just a prissy way of saying it helps us hear what we wouldn't be able to hear naturally. Question. And the big ears told you that Newton Thornton said, I'm hungry. Answer. Correct. Question. So what? Answer. Repeat that, sir? Question. I said, so what? He was hungry. He'd been on an island for days, nothing to eat. Wasn't it reasonable that the boy might be hungry? Answer. Yes, sir, he may have been. I suppose it was the way he said it. Question. The way? Answer. Yes, sir. He said it in a way that sounded like he was somehow more than just hungry. Hungry as you or I would know it, anyway. Maybe those starving kids you see on TV pledge drives might know that kind of hunger, but even them, I'm not sure. He sounded like he'd eat his own arm off, if he could just bring himself to cross that line. Question. Pardon me, Lance Corporal Ellis, but that sounds paranoid. Answer. I suppose it does. I think a lot of us were jumpy. We kept hearing things. Question. Out on the boat? Answer. No, I mean internally. Rumors. Stuff was starting to leak out about that psycho doctor's lab. They'd found some of those awful videos, the one with the poor gorilla or whatever. We were jumpy. That sort of stuff you can't just aim a gun at and eliminate. Question. But you did. Answer. I did, yes, but the boy said one of our trigger words. Question. Explain that. Answer. We'd been given orders. The chief petty officer came into the sniper's bunks and told us if anybody came off that island and spoke one of those trigger words, we had authority to open fire. Hungry was one of them. Question. Any others? Answer. I can't entirely remember. Worm, I'm sure, was one. Infected. Question. And so because a very hungry boy on a boat said he was hungry, he got himself shot. Answer. He was infected, sir. That much was made clear in the aftermath, and from what I've heard about some of the others, a bullet was an easy way to go. Question. You didn't answer my question. Answer. With all due respect, you didn't ask a question, sir. You made a statement, sir. I'll tell you this. I never trained as a combat sniper thinking one day I'd shoot a young boy on a boat. That's not why men join up. We're supposed to be doing it for God and country, and... Jesus. It haunts me. I heard people use that phrase, and I never quite understood. Honestly, I thought it was a bit histrionic. But I get it now. I know what it is to be haunted. That boy's face haunts me, sir, and it will until the day I depart this world for whatever's waiting for me. From Troop 52, Legacy of the Modified Hydatid, as published in GQ Magazine by Chris Packer. Max Kirkwood is the oldest-looking 15-year-old you'll ever see. His eyes fade into his head, and their edges are knitted with wrinkles. His hair has a stripped-out, mousy aspect. There is a pronounced stoop when he sits down. His shoulders are rounded and hunched in a gait one associates with the elderly.
He looks like someone who has been subjected to unimaginable pressures, and now, that pressure withdrawn, his body still bears the weight. You have to remind yourself that Max is still a boy. But he's a boy who has seen far more than most others his age. We speak through an impenetrable barrier at the clinic. It is not unlike the way inmates speak to their spouses in jail. There are phones on each side of the plexiglass. After I finish, an orderly will wipe down the earpiece with a powerful germ killer. The clinic operates at the highest levels of precaution. It took months of wrangling and compromise to secure a brief interview with Max. The clinic itself is a gargantuan boxy structure far removed from any population center. The things inside the clinic are potentially lethal to humankind. The humans who reside in the clinic aren't dangerous. What may be thriving inside them, though, are very dangerous. The viruses and contagions and parasites. The worms. Max is in good spirits today. He's wearing a paper gown and slippers. He tells me that everything is burned after he wears it, as a precaution. When you get a whole new wardrobe every day, I guess it's best they're made out of paper, he says with a wry smile. Max Kirkwood was spared. His fellow troopmate, Newton Thornton, was not. Why? That is as yet unknown. Recent revelations at the tribunal trial of Admiral Stonewall Brewer, chief tactical commander of the Falstaff Island event, indicate that the thinking may have been that Max would be a good candidate for study. There is a possibility he was spared because, if not, there would have been nobody left to gauge the effectiveness of the worm. It is shocking to believe such thinking may prevail at the upper echelons of the military establishment. Max is well clear of that now. In fact, he seems to remember little of his experience on Falstaff Island. It is entirely possible, of course, that he doesn't want to remember, that his mind, seeking peace, has simply jettisoned those memories. Who could blame him if that is the case? He speaks about the others in clipped, jagged sentences. They are the only aspects of the ordeal that he claims to truly recall, and by and large he recalls them with great fondness and care. Of Tim Riggs, his scoutmaster, Dr. Riggs was the coolest adult I ever knew, but he didn't try hard to be cool. He was actually sort of not cool, with the way he dressed and his fussiness, but he was cool because he treated us the way he'd treat grown-ups. Of Ephraim Elliott, Eef was my best friend. You could count on Eef. He always stuck up for you. He had a really big heart. I just think that, on the island, something crawled into his head and he couldn't get rid of it. Of Kent Jenks, I still have a hard time believing he's gone. I mean, he was like Superman. Really, he was. If anyone could have swum back to North Point, it was Big K. Of Shelley Longpre, there was something the matter with him. I'm not so sad about Shell, to be honest. That's a shitty thing to say, but whatever. Of Newton, Newt would have been a great dad. The best, I just know it. He knew so much, the strongest of any of us. I really wish we hadn't ragged on him so bad. When I ask him what else he can remember, his face grows distant, as if his mind is sprinting away from my question. There was a turtle, he says finally. He grows silent, then the words pour out in a shocking flood. Do you know how hard it is to kill something? Nothing wants to die. Things cling to their lives against all hope, even when it's hopeless. It's like the end is always there, you can't escape it, but things try so, so hard not to cross that finish line. So when they finally do, everything's been stripped away. Their bodies and happiness and hope. Things just don't know when to die. I wish they did. I wish my friends had known that. Sort of, anyway. But I'm glad they tried. That's part of being human, right? Part of being any living thing. You hold on to life until it gets ripped away from you. Even if it gets ripped away in pieces, you just hold on. He grows silent. His head dips. When he looks up again, his eyes are red at their edges, and he's near tears. I killed the turtle, he says simply. It seems the most wretched admission he's ever made. I want to reach out and hug him, but I can't because a thick barrier prevents it, and anyway, there may still be something inside of Max that could kill me. An orderly leads me away shortly after this. Max has been overstimulated. He needs to cool down. I walk out to my car. The sky is gray with the threat of rain. I try to put myself in Max's shoes on that island. I picture being confronted with a faceless, hungering threat that he never truly understood. And it amazes me that he, that all the boys, hung tough together. They didn't abandon each other. Maybe it never entered their minds that they could. Those ideas come with the dawn of adulthood and all the cruelties implicit in that stage of life. Email. To Alex Markson. Subject, hi. Message, blank. Hey, Alex. We don't even know each other, really, so maybe this is weird. But I don't know what's happened to you. You vanished off Facebook. I hope you're not gone for good. Frowny face. I'd miss all your great posts. So weird, I know, because you're a stranger. But it doesn't feel that way. I guess I was just thinking about you, maybe even a little worried, because of what's been happening lately in my little town. It's been crazy. Not good crazy. Scary crazy. Anyway, this is silly. I'm sure you're just taking a break, but still, I hope you're okay. Sincerely, is that weird? Trudy Dennison. Chapter 49. Some nights, Max Kirkwood would climb the bluffs on the outskirts of North Point and stare out over the water toward Falstaff Island. This was after it had all happened. After the arrival of the hungry man, the madness of the island. After he'd stood at the prow of Oliver McCanty's boat with the glowing red dot, a sniper's laser sight pinned to his chest. After the military decontamination, they had transferred him to an isolated clinic. He was toxic, after all. Infected. Or maybe not. They had poked and prodded, drawn pints of blood, endoscoped him, x-rayed him, done MRIs and cranial maps, dosed him with every vaccination known to mankind. After all that, they had judged him to be clean. It felt strange returning to North Point. Everything was the same, but everything was different. His scouting friends were gone. Those who'd been his friends before now kept their distance. People treated him differently. Most of them pitied him. Some, though, felt that he must have done horrible things on the island to have survived. Others crossed to the opposite side of the street when he came walking down it. At irregular intervals, a black van would show up at his house. Men in hazmat suits would get out. More tests. More needles. They collected his blood and fluids and solids in sterile pouches. It made Max laugh to think that some scientist in a white lab coat would be picking apart his shit with tweezers, frowning and tutting as he searched for clues. Well, it almost made him laugh. Max had bad dreams. Those were the only dreams he had anymore. Most nights it was just blackness. He closed his eyes and bang, black. 8 hours later, the black went away. He woke up. Those were the good nights. On the bad nights, his dreams were still black. But the blackness was infested with sounds. Squirming. Always this squirmy, squirmy noise in the blackness. And when he woke up, Max would be drooling like a baby. His mom kissed him goodnight on the forehead now. Used to be on the lips. He tried to return to the life he'd known, but that simply didn't exist anymore. He wasn't allowed to go to school. The parents of many students didn't feel right having Max in the same airspace with their kids. Nothing against Max personally. He was a good kid. A survivor. But the things Max had encountered on the island were survivors, too. The parents had read the newspapers. One of Dr. Edgerton's videotaped experiments had leaked online. Everyone knew what those things could do. Objectively, they did, anyhow. Everyone had seen things, clinically, but those things hadn't touched them. Not in any tangible way. So people knew in their brains, but not inside their skin, and there was a difference. Everybody thought they knew what had happened on that island. Everyone was an expert. But they didn't really know. What they thought was bad. What really happened was a lot worse. Max studied at home. The teachers sent assignments to him in paper envelopes. He had to send his answers back via email, as the teachers expressed concern over actually handling the papers he'd touched. One morning, he found a poster tacked to his front door. It was supposed to look like a carnival poster, like for the freak tent. "The Amazing Worm Boy," read the blood-dripping type underneath. His mother made sweet and sour pork for dinner one night. The smell was so familiar to Max, that high, stinking sweetness, that he started to scream. He didn't stop until his father tossed the pan of pork outside in a snowbank. It took him a while on account of the fact that he limped real bad. The MPs had shattered his right kneecap after he and Kent's dad stole Calvin Walmack's cigarette boat. Max kept to himself. No choice, really. He wandered the woods and down by the sea. He thought about his friends, Kent and Eve and Newt especially. He'd recall the strangest, most trivial things, like Cub Car Rally Night. One year, his car had lost to Kent's car in the finals, except everyone thought Kent's dad helped him build the car. Its wheels were thin as pizza cutters. Eve's mom had said it was cheating. Newt's mom agreed. Things got pretty heated. Kent's dad kicked over the canteen of McDonald's orange drink and stormed out. Eve's mom's eyes had popped out, and she'd said, "And that man is our police chief." Max missed them all so much. It was weird. They'd all had other friends, but now Max couldn't think of any friends who'd mattered as much. He'd give anything to have one more day with them, even one of those piss-away ones they used to have in Scouts, roaming the woods on a fall day with the smoky smell of dead leaves crunching under their boots, playing King of the Mountain and Would You Rather, while nerdy Newt collected samples for some dumb merit badge or another, stealing away with Ephraim to stare at the stars and dream their crazy dreams. And they would all be just like they were before, not skinny or hungry or trying to hurt one another. There was nothing Max wouldn't give to have that again. Just one more day. And Shelley? Well, Shelley wasn't in these daydreams. If Shell popped up at all, it was in his nightmares. Max had a shrink now, the same one Newton and Ephraim used to visit. When he'd told Dr. Harley about wishing for one more day with his old friends, he'd been advised against wishing for things that couldn't happen. Harley called this negative projection. Max thought Harley was an idiot. If there was one thing he wanted to tell his lost friends, it was that lots of adults didn't have a goddamn clue. It was one of the sadder facts he'd had to come to grips with. Adults could be just as stupid as kids. Stupider even, because often they didn't have to answer to anybody. Of course, Harley wore a face mask during their sessions, same as a doctor would wear when he's operating. Same as Scoutmaster Tim had worn, probably. Sometimes Max wanted to rip it off and cough into his stupid suckerfish face. The Amazing Worm Boy strikes again. Chapter 50. One evening, Max borrowed his uncle's boat and piloted it toward Falstaff Island. His heart jogged faster as the island came into view, rising against the horizon like the hump of a breaching whale. It was charred black, nothing but the odd burnt tree spiking up from the earth. The water had the sterile chlorine smell of a public pool. It was the most desolate place he'd ever seen. It echoed the desolation inside of him. The emptiness. The emptiness? Max leaned both hands on the gunwale. A nameless hunger was building inside of him. It gnawed at his guts with teeth that called his name.
The Troop was written by Nick Cutter and read by Corey Brill. Editing and post-production by Matt Cartsonis. The associate producer was Louisa Solomon. The Troop was produced by Matt Cartsonis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Troop is available in hardcover from Gallery Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.